supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Cyclists are becoming increasingly impatient with Philadelphia's slow pace of installing and upgrading the city's bike lane network. Despite lobbying and protests, City Council and the mayor have lagged on authorizing new or improved bike lanes. Frustrated with politicians, cyclists are now turning to the courts. Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly reports.
Here's something you don't hear a lawyer say every day.
I did not know that that would be a result of this litigation.
Especially not when his client's happy.
This is definitely a good outcome.
Cyclist Kyle Leach and his attorney, Stuart Leon, filed a lawsuit against the parking valets outside the new Fairfield Inn and Suites in Center City, Philadelphia. You see, there's a bike lane right in front of the hotel, and guests constantly park in it instead of using the valet stand on the other side of the street. So Leon went to work.
I sued to get the valet activities out of the bike lane.
And the valet company's owner, Dan Bell, decided to settle.
So we've all agreed to work together to make sure that we can put a permanent, delineator post.
Bell will pick up the $3,500 tab for installing the plastic barriers, which can help keep cars out of bike lanes. He's a cyclist himself.
We're all for that. We want to make sure that Uber, Lyft, and other random vehicles aren't pulling up in the zone and blocking that bike lane.
The handshake agreement still needs Philly Streets Department to sign off. Attorney Leon says he's gotten a verbal okay from officials, but they declined to comment, saying that they had not yet, quote, received any formal paperwork regarding this matter. For years now, bike safety advocates have pressed the city's elected officials for more protected bike lanes. But some residents and businesses don't like them because unprotected bike lanes make for handy short-term parking spots. And because voters seem pretty evenly divided on the issue, politicians haven't done much. So, feeling let down by the city's executive and legislative branches, the cyclists are turning to the judiciary to make things happen. And they're using lawsuits against private entities, not the city, to do it. Leon says this lawsuit might be the first of many.
I am willing to file these lawsuits wherever else I think it can result in a protected bike lane.
It's unclear whether similar suits would succeed if defendants decide to put up a fight. But lawyers cost more than plastic, so the threat of litigation may be all the cyclists need. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
Earlier this month, President Donald Trump tweeted that, quote, tariffs are working big time. He has indicated that the tariffs are intended to bring about better trade deals. Let's get perspective on how the administration's actions are affecting our region so far with Dr. Ram Mudambi from Temple University's Fox School of Business. Ram, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
I'm delighted to be here, Dave.
Now, just months in, is it possible to get a handle of how our region is being affected by the tariffs?
I think we can get some ideas on that, but the effects on our region, I would hasten to say, are really local manifestations of some very, very broad economic theories that we have known for two centuries now.
Now, regarding the theoretical, are you in accord with most economists who say this is a dangerous path we're going down?
I think so. I think many years ago, one of my favorite economists, Milton Friedman, said that since the time of Adam Smith, almost no professional economist has thought that tariffs are a good idea.
And as we are increasingly global in nature, it must become harder and harder to try to isolate oneself.
Indeed. Our global economy is considerably more interdependent than it has ever been before. And so the dangers of unraveling, unpackaging what we have achieved are going to be quantitatively much larger today than they would have been 30 or 40 years ago. The U.S. economy, even as recently as the 1970s, the U.S. economy was probably around 5% exposed to the global economy. Today, the number is higher than 20%. This in itself is an understatement of the true impact of our global integration and meshing of our economy.
Let's then consider some of the sectors that are amply represented in our greater region, for example, medicine and pharma.
If we look at the list of items to be hit with tariffs, We have things like technology, network routers, computer components, a lot of things like pork and agricultural goods and fish. So I would say that our two big sectors, biopharma and education. Biopharma at this point looks to be off the list, but education is certainly, we are seeing the effects daily in terms of the more stringent immigration restrictions on educational visas.
Last month, to offset problems for farmers, the president announced a government assistance program to the tune of $12 billion. Will that help the situation for agriculture in our region?
I think you bring up a very good point here, Dave, and that is that federal tariffs are part of a very complex tiered system. Oftentimes what we see is changes in one are sometimes offset by making other changes in other places. You can create some local relief to providing benefits in this form. Let me provide you with a local example. One sector that the president has talked about is solar panels. The Chinese particularly are argued to heavily subsidize their solar panel industry. However, most experts believe that the effects on our local region of these tariffs is likely to not be very significant for two reasons. One is that the most of the Philadelphia area solar panel industry is focused very much on residential and small business installation. And secondly, Governor Wolf has announced very significant promotion to support the solar panel industry. And it is expected that these promotions will more than offset the effects of any tariffs that were to be imposed on the Chinese industry. So clearly, when we talk about tariffs, we need to consider the fact that they're part of a bigger system. And so it's not immediately obvious that they're going to have the same effects in every case.
Will the average consumers across our region and indeed the country feel the pain of prices going up?
I think there's absolutely no doubt, again, speaking of the professional economists, that tariffs are going to cause prices to go up. Will it cause all prices in all situations to go up everywhere by the same amount? The answer is no. Some areas will see prices going up higher than others. Our consumption basket here in the Philadelphia area is probably not that different from most metros in the country in terms of what we buy and what we consume. And so we are likely to see the same kinds of price increases that any other urban center of the U.S. would see.
Dr. Mudambi, thank you for joining us to offer a perspective on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Ram Mudambi from Temple University's Fox School of Business. Point Breeze residents have been in an uproar since a neighborhood memorial mural was destroyed to make way for a developer's project. As WHYY's Annette John Hall reports, a developer eager to stake his claim to prime property came away with a lasting lesson about the importance of community.
Daryl Roberts couldn't believe what he saw. The Stop the Violence mural, painted with the names of young people whose lives had been lost to gun violence, had been a fixture in the neighborhood for 30 years. Now it was falling apart, name by name. Only a few painted names were left on the layer of cement that mounted the mural, exposing the brick wall behind it.
I didn't know if it was falling down or if it was being taken down until we found out what was really going on.
It turns out that the mural is on the wall of a building being partially torn down to make way for a new 5-bedroom house. That didn't sit well with Roberts, a lifelong Point Breeze resident. One of the names painted on the mural was that of his cousin, Marcus Yates.
Balloons released at 60th and Springfield in memory of Marcus Yates, a 5-year-old child shot to death at this corner 30 years ago today.
In 1988, Marcus and 10 other children were playing inside a deli when two rival drug dealers opened fire.
In the middle of a crossfire, trying to get out of the store, he was killed. Several other family members were hit by gunfire.
For Roberts, the mural stands for more than a scroll of names, and it's one of the reasons he's leery of all the rapid development.
You know, they look nice, but when you start coming towards our murals, our memory lanes, and then being a relative of one of the names on the wall, makes it hurt more.
We're taking in what's left of the mural on a recent Saturday morning. Neighborhood ballers are already playing full court, while other residents, many of them young and white, are out walking their dogs. It's a scene that reflects the shifting demographics in a changing neighborhood. Over the past 16 years, census data shows, there has been a 700% increase in median housing prices in Point Breeze, while the black population has decreased by almost half. It's a hot spot for developers. In November, Stephen Brown of Urban Living Group bought the dilapidated 5-bedroom house that the mural's on with plans to rehab it and sell it for $480,000.
This was a shell of a residential unit that was about to collapse. And we decided because of the mural, we were going to try to rehab it and preserve it. The brick and the cement barrier were pulling apart, causing fragments of the wall to fall. And I was concerned from a safety perspective, I didn't want anybody to get hurt.
With the wall already starting to crumble, Brown decided to take down the mural. But he says he planned to replace it and that he didn't think to inform the community about his plans. Outraged neighbors, watching the mural being destroyed with no explanation, complained to Councilman Kenyatta Johnson and then held a community meeting where they let Brown know how they felt.
I took a lot of criticism at the meeting, and a lot of people were very upset, and I totally can relate to that because these are their family members.
At a meeting this week, community leaders say the replacement mural will feature the same names along with some artistic embellishments. It is Robert's hope that the new mural is celebrated with as much reverence as the commemoration his family had for his cousin Marcus earlier this summer.
Invite the families, if they can get in touch with the families, and do an unveiling of the wall, a rededication or something like that, and have the developer come and be there so he can see not just the wall with names, but he can see the families that were impacted by the violence that took the lives of these names.
Brown and other donators will pay for the mural. It's expected to go up sometime this fall. Annette John Hall, WHYY News.
Now just under 3 months out from the midterm elections, the Campaign Legal Center continues its efforts to ensure that eligible voters have access to the ballot. And as of this week, that now includes the launching of an online tool to aid former felons in restoring their voting rights. Skadden Foundation fellow Blair Bowie is among the center's organization of attorneys working in Washington, D.C., and joins me now. Blair, thanks for being here on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
So is there great variation in the status of felons who serve their term in terms of their eligibility to vote?
Yes, the laws vary all across the U.S. Some states never take away people's right to vote, and some states will permanently disenfranchise people depending on their type of conviction.
So let's focus on our tri-state region.
Sure. So in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, everyone who has a felony conviction and is currently serving time is disenfranchised. But in Pennsylvania, people can vote immediately upon release from prison. So even if they're still on probation or parole, they can get registered to vote. Now, in New Jersey, they will have to wait until they've fully completed their sentence, including probation and parole, before they can get registered and vote again. Same in Delaware as New Jersey. Unless they've been convicted of murder, manslaughter, a felony involving public administration, like bribery or abuse of office, or a felony sexual abuse, in which case they would have to seek a pardon to get their voting rights back.
Does the Legal Center have a sense of how many potential voters fall into this category?
Well, it's hard to say. So I can tell you that in Pennsylvania, for example, there's over 52,000 people who are currently disenfranchised, meaning that they're still serving prison time. However, it's hard to say exactly how many people are out of prison but have felony convictions and are under the impression that they can't vote even though they can. But we assume that that's many more people who are just unaware that they're able to exercise their right to vote.
And I imagine that's part of the intent of launching this online tool. How does it work?
So the tool is really easy to use. You just go to restoreyourvote.org, and input which state you reside in and want to vote in, and then it will ask you a series of questions to determine your voting rights status and what you need to do to get registered. You know, there's 23 million people in America that have felony convictions. About 6 million of those people are directly disenfranchised by felony disenfranchisement. But of those 17 million others, a lot of them think that they can't vote, and they're actually incorrect. They could vote. And the point of this tool is to make it really easy for people to figure out whether they can vote or not.
What was the original intent of disenfranchisement laws?
Well, that varies from state to state. We work quite a bit in the South, where many of the laws are actually Jim Crow laws that are still on the books. And their intent there was to disenfranchise black people.
Over time, are you seeing that these disenfranchisement laws are being eased or even made more draconian?
I think we're seeing a trend towards easing some of these laws.
Alabama is a case in point.
Exactly. Alabama last year passed a law that we believe will re-enfranchise about half the people that were disenfranchised. Florida has a ballot initiative this year that could re-enfranchise up to 1.7 million people in the state who've lost their voting rights because of a conviction. I think that Americans understand the value of second chances and believe that people shouldn't be forever punished for the worst thing they've ever done, especially since we're primarily talking about people who have, you know, served their debt to society, they've completed their time, they've served their sentences, and people think that they should be able to vote again.
Blair, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Blair Bowie is a Skadden Foundation Fellow at the Campaign Legal Center. Aretha Franklin has died. The Queen of Soul, who's been an icon of American music for half a century, has been battling cancer. She was 76. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports on her time in Philadelphia.
The last time Aretha Franklin performed in Philadelphia was one of her last performances anywhere. It was almost exactly a year ago at the Mann Center for the Performing Arts. The president of the Mann, Kathy Cahill, had Franklin on before, in 2010, and noticed that at that time she was quite heavy set. In 2017, she came back among rumors of health problems, and Cahill said she had lost a dramatic amount of weight.
You didn't recognize her. She had lost so much weight, it was just phenomenal. Between 2010 and 2017, it looked like two different women on our stage. That said, her voice was still in good form. She was still commanding, if you will, the stage, and having her audience eat out of the right of the palm of her hand.
Aretha Franklin started performing when she was just 14 years old in 1956 in churches around Detroit. That was the same time she recorded her first album, Songs of Faith. She soon crossed over from gospel into pop and jazz. In a 1999 interview with Terry Gross of Fresh Air, Franklin said her father, a preacher, always had music in the house.
As a very small girl, I listened to Charlie Parker and loved him. Max Roach and people like that. I had not been in the jazz environment, having been brought up in the church. But once I got to New York, I was signed to perform at the Village Gate and the Vanguard and clubs like that.
Franklin had a long, long string of hits over her career. Too many to list here, but I'll give it a shot. Respect, Think, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, Chain of Fools. One of her minor hits was Brand New Me. It was a cover of a Jerry Butler song co-written by Kenny Gamble of Philadelphia International Records.
This is my same old coat.
I think that she has done a wonderful thing with the life that's been given her. She sang her heart and soul out for people. She made some people laugh, made some people cry. All you gotta do is put the Aretha Franklin record on and you can feel her soul.
She's a brand new girl on me, just because of you,
because of you,
just because of you. Oh, oh, just
Franklin had few personal ties to Philadelphia, but a long track record of performing here. She started in the smaller jazz clubs of the 60s, like Pep's and the Cadillac Club. She moved on to larger venues like the Uptown Theater on North Broad, and more recently, the Kimmel Center on South Broad. Perhaps the biggest show she ever played was on the Parkway in 2015 for Pope Francis. Millions around the world watched it live. When Franklin was off stage, she was a very private person, only close to carefully selected people. One of them was Deanna Williams, a DJ on Philadelphia radio station WRNB.
Musically, she had a connection through Gamble Huff and Jerry Butler, and her performances at Pep's, the Uptown, and other venues. But forever, she has a place in Philadelphians' heart. You know, people are moved. They are claiming her as a family friend.
Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.